This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Get started. My name is David Amaral. I'm the research director at the Mind Institute, and I'd like to welcome you all to this distinguished lecture session on behalf of the Mind Institute. Normally we have these lectures at our Sacramento building, but there was so much interest in our speaker for today that we decided to have it here at Freeborn Hall, and I'm glad we did. I'm going to, in a moment, turn you over to Dr. Marjorie Solomon, who will introduce our speaker for today. I just wanted first to ask you all to turn off your pagers and cell phones so we can have an uninterrupted lecture. And invite you in the future. You have a brochure on your seats describing the remainder of our lectures, and invite you to come out to our Sacramento building to hear the other speakers in the series. I'm sure that you'll find them rewarding as well. So there's a few seats for those of you in the back. There's a few seats that are empty up front. Please come on forward and take these seats. We have just about a full house. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Marjorie Solomon, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. And Marjorie will introduce our speaker for today.
Thank you, David. I'd like to welcome you all to the Mind Institute Distinguished Speaker Series. As evidenced by our need to move this talk to an auditorium at least four times the size of our own, our speaker tonight, Dr. Temple Grandin, needs little introduction. Most people are lucky if they achieve prominence in one career during their lifetime. Our speaker today has distinguished herself in at least two. Dr. Grandin earned her PhD in animal science from the University of Illinois in 1989. She currently is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She consults extensively with the livestock industry on facility design and livestock handling. Close to half of the cattle in the United States are handled in a system she designed. She's received numerous awards for her work in the beef industry and in the humane treatment of animals. Her book, Animals in Translation, was nominated as a top science book of the year by Discover Magazine in 2006. However, since this is the Mind Institute speaker series, you've probably come to hear about Dr. Grandin's second distinguished career. In this second career, Dr. Grandin has truly given of herself in helping us all to better understand the experience of being a person with autism. As you'll see this evening, Dr. Grandin is extremely articulate in describing her perceptions. Consequently, she's been an invited guest on most of the top TV news and radio talk shows in the country. She also is a superb writer and has authored several books about her own life, Thinking in Pictures and Emergence, as well as several more practical works about critical issues for persons with autism. These include Developing Talents by Autism Asperger Press and Understanding Unwritten Rules, which is published by Future Horizons. As both a parent of three sons and a professional who works with children on the autism spectrum, Dr. Grandin's life history and accomplishments serve as a clear reminder to me, and perhaps to us all, that our job as parents of children with and without autism is to help them to discover what they love, to help them to clarify their strengths and their challenges, and to imbue them with sufficient internal strength to make their mark on the world. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Dr. Temple Grandin, whose first talk is entitled Exploring the Mind of a Visual Thinker.
Well, it's good to be here today, and I hope everybody can hear me okay. And I think I'll start out and just tell a little bit about myself. When I was a little kid, I had all of the full-blown symptoms of autism. I had no language, no speech. Now, you may have heard about Asperger's syndrome. That's just a milder form of autism. Autism is a continuum of traits, going from very severe to scientists like Einstein. In fact, if you got rid of all of the autism genes, you probably wouldn't have any Silicon Valley. You wouldn't have any iPods. You wouldn't have any electricity or a whole lot of other kinds of things. It's like a little bit of the genetics. You get, you know, famous scientists. You get too much, you're going to get somebody that's going to remain nonverbal. And the thing about understanding both autism and animals is you've got to get away from language. See, in the normal human brain, language covers up visual thinking, auditory thinking, and let's say you're working with somebody that's nonverbal. They don't think in language. An animal doesn't think in language. And it's possible to have thinking without having any language. Now, the thing about the autistic mind is it tends to look at details. Okay, you see these letters up here? You know, you got the big letter there, and that's made out of the little letters. Person on the spectrum has an easier time picking out the little letters. In fact, when this test was done on me, I was faster with the little letters. It's details. Animals are also in the details. They see sensory details. Animals look at details. And the other thing is, it's sensory-based. It's not, you know, language-based. Now, I've done a lot of work with cattle, and cattle get afraid of a lot of silly things. And at this particular feedlot, they were going to rip down the work area. The cattle didn't want to go into the chute to get vaccinated. Now, what was wrong here was a flag there. You've got high contrast, and you've got rapid movement. Plus, it makes a scary sound that sort of sounds like fire. All they had to do was move the flag, and then everything would have just been fine. They were ready to spend $100,000 tearing down their facility when all they needed to do was take a flag down. Here's a cow's eye view into a vaccinating chute, and look at all the shadows. Oftentimes, it's much worse on a sunny day. They can see people through the side. You know, I've got to get people to be more observant. The thing about thinking in language is you tend to oversimplify things. I've done a lot of work on making standards for animal handling. And somebody will say, well, handle them properly. Well, what does handle them properly mean? What does give them sufficient space mean? Some people might think sufficient space is fine if all the pigs are all on top of each other. I wouldn't consider that sufficient space. There's a dark entrance into a chute. They're afraid of the dark. I do a lot of work with the meat plants, and I always get asked, they're afraid of getting slaughtered. No, they're more afraid of the dark. They're afraid of a coat hung on the fence, a hose on the ground, a reflection. And if you get rid of those things they're afraid of, they'll walk right in. Now, what is thinking in pictures? This picture was sent to me by a young autistic man. In fact, it's in a book called Little Rain Man. And he's very much a visual thinker, and he drew a movie projector inside his head. Now, there may be some young people today that don't know what those round things are. You know, 16-millimeter movie reels. Thinking in pictures is like having Google for images in your head. And the thing is, there's a logic to Google for images. You type in a keyword, yep, and it pulls up a lot of things, and then it can kind of get off the subject. But it's associational. Let's say I typed in saucer, and I might get a picture of a cup and saucer. But then I might get a picture of a flying saucer. And then I get a picture of the hangar at Area 51. You see, there is a kind of logic to it. How many people here have done Google for images? Okay, and anyone who hasn't done it needs to do it. Because I want to get you some insight into how the visual thinking mind works. And you can think without having language. Now, lots of times, some autistic kids, art talent will show up really early. You'll see perspective drawing at around age 9. The thing about the autistic mind and the Asperger mind is it tends to be a specialist mind. Good at one thing, bad at something else. We have too much emphasis on the deficits and not enough emphasis on building up the strength area. My parents did everything they could do to nurture my ability in art. And in my work on designing cattle handling facilities, I'm using my visual thinking skill. In fact, I can test run a cattle handling facility in my head. I didn't know that was a special skill. I thought everybody thought in pictures. I didn't realize that other people don't think in pictures until I started questioning people about how do they think. And I had this little question I'd ask, access your memory on church steeples. Well, when I think about church steeples, I see specific ones. The one I voted in, the one next door, the church I went to as a child, I see specific steeples. But I was shocked to find out that most people just see sort of a generalized image. And sometimes it's quite a detailed general image. But then there's some people that just see like this, two lines, and that's all they see. And then I found a few people where there's no image at all. Like most people, if I said to you, walk through your own house in your mind, you could walk through your own house in your mind. Because most people are so familiar with it, but there are a few people that can't. I found a lady who was a speech therapist, and when I had dinner at her house, and I asked her if she could visualize her office over at the university, and she was not able to do it. That's rare, but they exist. But it was shocking for me to discover more and more that the way I think wasn't the way other people thought. There's one of my cattle handling facilities. Half the cattle in this country, when they go to a meat plant, they're handling equipment that I designed. There's another one of my facilities down in Brazil. And I really like this job because I like to fantasize about what the archaeologists are going to think this is for when they dig it up in the future. Okay, for the people back there, we got a few seats down here in the front. We got about 10 or 15 seats in the front. Come on up. This isn't church. There's some seats over there. Now, when I first started working on my designing, it took me quite a while to learn how to relate drawings to the picture in my head. I'd get a picture in my head of how to design something, but I had to learn how to relate the drawing to the picture. And the way I learned this was I got the floor plans for the Swift meatpacking plant in Arizona. And I took the floor plans. It was a whole entire plant, had the parking lot, it had the water tower, it had everything on it. And I had to learn that a circle on the drawing was the water tower. So I took the drawing and I walked around the water tower. And then I walked through the building and I was able to locate where all the doors were, locate where all the equipment was. So that kind of symbolic line then got related to a picture. Took me quite a long time to learn how to do that. Then after I had learned how to do that, then being able to draw sort of just magically appeared. But there was a long period of programming my mind to relate a drawing to the actual thing. There's one of my handling facilities. There's a drawing of it right there. There's a drawing of the curved facility. And I find in teaching my design students, I have to kind of switch back and forth between this and this. Because I've got to get them to see the picture when they look at the drawing. You know, I have found that people that have never done hand drafting make horrible perceptual mistakes on drawings. People that have never built anything with their hands don't understand mechanical things. You know, one of the problems I'm seeing with some of the largest meat companies is when the old people switched over to the computer, everything was just fine. But some of the young people coming in, they've never built anything, they've never drawn by hand, they'd make weird mistakes on drawings, like not having the center of the circle in the center of the circle, or maybe 25-foot long gates. I mean, there's no way 25-foot long gates could possibly work. Here are some of the common mistakes. Radius point in the wrong place. I find that in my class, my worst design students make that mistake. Uneven alley widths. They don't actually swing the gates on the drawing. They're not seeing it. Now, how do you form a concept when you think in pictures? Well, this young man sent me this picture that showed how he sorted dog and cat images into little boxes inside his head. You sort the cats and the dogs. Well, how does he do that? Well, a dog is bigger than a cat. So in the beginning, I just sort them by size. But that doesn't work when you got a little tiny dog. So when our next door neighbors bought a dachshund, I had to figure out why Rosie was not a cat. And I studied her 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 so much until I finally figured out that every dog, no matter how little, has the same nose. I had to find a visual feature every single dog has that none of the cats have. It's sensory-based forming of categories. And there's been some very interesting neuroscience research that shows that the brain sets up categories. The information is put in this file folder or that file folder. And one of the problems that a person with autism often has is making new file folders, thinking up new categories. Dr. Nancy Minshew at the University of Pittsburgh's done quite a lot of work on this. Now, another sensory way that I could categorize dogs and cats is barking or meowing. How about smell? They smell differently. They feel differently. You know, there's other ways I can make them a category. Now, I finally had this brain scan done, Dr. Nancy Minshew's lab, that helped explain my visual thinking. And that these big trunk lines that form in all brains, and I'm the red one there, I got bigger ones than with sex-aged matched control. And a similar result was found in some other 20-year-old people with autism with a normal IQ. There's been a lot of work on the early brain development. And some of Eric Horchain's work shown that the visual cortex in the brain is the one part that's normal. And some other fascinating research showed that non-visual information is processed visually. Nancy's got another fabulous paper where they put people in the scanner and they asked them sentences. And they had to answer true or false. And there was stuff like, cats, dogs, and rocks are all alive, true or false. That would be a high visual. Or adding and subtraction of both math. That would be a low visual. Now, when I read the paper, I saw my third grade teacher's classroom when I read the question that's supposed to be the non-visual question. And the person with autism processes those in the visual part of the brain, you know, rather than in the language, you know, part of the brain. And there's a slice in a little different position in the brain. I got a real big one there on the right, but I don't have very much on the left. When I got those scans back, I go, oh, man, this is a real mind blower. Because I used to joke around about how I have this giant internet connection going deep into the visual cortex. And I sort of like to visualize the brain as a big corporate office tower. And you know, there's all the connections between the different departments. And the CEO, the frontal cortex up at the top, he's got really lousy email, lousy phones. But maybe there's an internet connection right straight into the art department. When I first started out, I thought all people on the spectrum were visual thinker like me. I'm the kind of thinker who thinks in photorealistic pictures, like Google for images. I'm horrible at algebra. And they pounded away on algebra. That was a big mistake. Big mistake. We should have gone to geometry and trig. One of the things that saved me was a fantastic mentor science teacher. Because we've got to take what these kids are good at and build on it. If a kid's obsessed with trains, then you teach reading with trains. Teach math with trains. Then there's another kind of thinker that's described in this new book on Born on a Blue Morning about the mathematical savant that was profiled on 60 Minutes. He's a pattern thinker. Music and math, pattern thinker. It's a form of visual thinking, but it's more abstract. And he's converting numbers into patterns, into color patterns, different kinds of patterns. Then there's another kind, and I call them the verbal logic. This is the guy that loves history, knows all the sports scores, not a visual thinker. They're a word thinker. Now let's think about the brain. I mean, some of the research is showing that there's maybe not enough cables to go around to hook up all the different departments in the office building. So what tends to happen is, maybe my graphic designer's got it all. And maybe the accounting and the statistics department in another person's brain gets it all. And maybe other departments in the word thinker get it all. But there's a tendency for them to be good at one thing and really bad at something else. Very uneven skills. And you look at the people on the spectrum that are successful. The skill area was developed. There's a lot of people in Silicon Valley that were apprenticed into their industry by the parents. At age 8, computer programming is introduced, and they're literally just apprenticed in. Another thing that really has helped people, that helped me, was my strict 50s upbringing. I was taught manners. I was taught to say please and thank you. I had to sit through church, even though I thought it was boring. Now, we didn't have, fortunately in our church, we didn't have electronic blasting rock and roll music. I wouldn't be able to stand that. You have to differentiate between naughty to bad behavior and sensory overload. And you get the child in sensory overload, things are just not going to work. Fancy Sunday dinner at Granny's, I was expected to sit for 20 minutes and use my knife and fork. And, you know, there were some expectations for behavior. And you get into some of the very, very smart Asperger's now. The milder forms, I think they're having more problems today, because it didn't get that strict upbringing where there were some expectations. You know, blow a little fit in church, man, there were going to be some repercussions for that. You know, and one of the things I learned is, well, sometimes you got to do stuff that grown-ups want you to do, even if it is boring. You just have to sit still and you just have to do it. Now, I put in this picture from Extreme Origami. This came out of Discover Magazine. And you see that praying mantis? It's made out of origami. That pattern in the background, that's the folding pattern. Now, I don't understand that kind of, I can't do this. But I'm trying to give you a glimpse into another kind of mind. And I've had to really stretch myself to try to understand how that other kind of mind works. Now, you can read my book, Thinking in Pictures, which unfortunately, they ran out of it because they didn't send enough copies in. They ordered them, but they didn't get sent. But Barnes & Noble and other places have it. And in that, I talk about the photorealistic visual thinking. And now you've got this pattern kind of mind that's described in this On a Blue Morning book. It's specialized, but it's a different kind of specialized. And here's Van Gogh's Starry Night. I thought this was just fascinating. Some mathematicians got a hold of this, and they looked at the swirl patterns and said that these follow the statistical model of water turbulence. Van Gogh didn't know anything about water turbulence, but he's painting these in his paintings. See, this is the kind of visual thinking, pattern thinking mind that's covered up by language in most people. And there's a lot of famous scientists and artists that probably had autistic or Asperger traits. Carl Sagan, Mozart, Einstein. I mean, Einstein had no language till age 3. And the thing that concerns me is, what would happen to Einstein today? Could a patent clerk, he was a patent clerk in the Swiss patent office, could a patent clerk get a paper published today in a prestigious physics journal? Probably not. Maybe he might be out there driving a truck or something like that. Yeah, real shame. Now, why did I put the dog up here? Well, let's say you're working with a person on the spectrum that's a little, you know, maybe nonverbal, and I got to teach them a concept like not running across the street. Over and over, parents have said to me, my kid knows the rules at home, but then at school he runs across the street, or at Granny's he runs across the street. You got to teach them at home, at school, at the library, at church, at the shopping mall, at a whole bunch of places, not to run across the street. Now, to teach this guide dog for the blind about what to do at an intersection, I have to show him many different examples of intersections. Ones that have white lines, ones that have lights, ones that have stop signs, ones that have curbs, no curbs, dirt roads. And then you get all these pictures in his brain of all these different intersections to form an intersection concept. But if I only show the dog intersections with white lines, he won't know what to do on the ones that have no white lines. And I want to make sure that when he goes to a strange city, he knows what to do. Now, here are just some common objects, hats, pens and things. If you say to a child on the spectrum, pick out all the red things, they can do that. But you know what? They might not pick out any, because it's a little white on the ball. There's black there showing on one of the videotape cartridges. So then we get into the concept of partly red. You cut things up for fractions. But we need to teach flexible thinking. We need to teach making new file folders. Some other work that Dr. Minshew did, she found out that one of the things these kids have a hard time is making up a new category, like containing plastic, containing metal, objects that are round, objects that are used for work. Now, the thing about the category of objects used for work is it's going to depend upon who's wearing the hats and where they're being worn at, because they can be worn for either work or for play. Is autistic learning just a bunch of memorization and scripting? Yep, in the beginning it is. Now, as the more experiences I got, and the more places I went to and things that I did, it was like loading web pages into my head. Because if my mind works like Google for images, I've got to have web pages in here that I can surf and pictures that I can surf. So the more things I'm exposed to, I got more experiences. Okay, I told that guy off. That was really a bad thing to do. I kicked somebody in the head. That was a totally bad thing to do. I did something else. You know, I had a good result from that. And when I get into a new situation, I got to go back into my mind with my Google for images and find a web page of a similar situation. So I think it's important to get these kids exposed to a lot of stuff, and then I can take that information, all those web pages I've now got in my mind, and put them into categories. Now, here's an interesting thing with animals, very much visual thinking. This horse is described in my book, Animals in Translation, the black hat horse. Deathly afraid of black hats. He was abused by somebody wearing a black hat. When he was abused, he was looking right at a black hat. Notice, white cowboy hats are fine. Black cowboy hat, if I put it on the ground, I could get the horse to touch it. If that hat was on somebody's head, you wouldn't have gotten that horse within 50 feet of it, you know, without having a rearing. See, that's a visual fear memory. You know, it's a... And the problem you've got with this visual fear memory is Joseph Ledoux's research has shown you cannot erase the visual fear memory. You can teach the brain to close the file. But to use computer talk is you can close the file, but it's still on the hard drive. You cannot delete the file. So let's make sure if you're taking a kid in that gets blood drawn or something, let's make this not a horrible experience, or you're not going to get him back in that room again. In the mind of the horse and the mind of cattle, a person on the back and a person on the ground are two totally different things. A real common thing with horses is, let's say he was roughed up by somebody riding, he'd be afraid of riders, but he'd be just fine with people on the ground. Or if he was abused by people on the ground, you can't shoe him, you can't do vet work, but you can ride it. You see, that's two different file folders. Cattle have to be trained to both handling by people walking and handling by people riding. So they learn how to do both. Here are just some examples of specific fear memories. A dog, this is a weird thing with dogs. A dog, when he gets hit by a car, often gets afraid of the place where he was hit, the piece of road where he was hit, not cars. You know, because he was looking right at the piece of road when he was hit. A common thing you can get with horses is one kind of bit is okay, another kind of bit is bad. Think about it. Different bits are going to feel different. They're different feeling pictures. And maybe a jointed bit is bad, and a one-piece bit is okay. And I've seen situations where you just change the bit, and then the horse is fine. And another common thing that happens, boy, I can tell you, in a zoo, the zoo animals know who the bad vet is that darted him with a dart gun. They know his voice. They know what he looks like. They just can't get near him. Do animals have true thinking or cognition? I like the way Marion Stamp Dawkins defines thinking. It's solving a problem under a new condition. It's figuring out something in a new way, in a novel way. This is what it's not. It's not just operant or classical conditioning. That's just simple associative learning. Okay, press the switch, get a treat. You know, light comes on, jump over a barrier, avoid a shock. That's associative learning. It's also not these hardwired instinctual behaviors. You know, like a bull smells a cow in estrus, he curls up its lip. A dog will do that little play bow where he puts his butt in the air because he wants you to play with him. Those are hardwired instinctual behaviors that are sort of like nature's little software programs. Now, here's an example of true thinking in a crow. And what they did is they gave this crow some bent paper clips, and she figured out how to reach down this little thingy and pull up the food bucket. Then and they took away her bent paper clips and gave her straight wires. She's sticking them in. She can't get the food bucket out. Then she sticks it in a crack and bends it and makes a hook. That is true cognition. She solved a problem. And I think the orienting response is the beginning of thinking. You've all seen a deer hear something, and it goes like this, and it looks. And when it goes like that, and it looks, it makes a decision. Do I keep looking? Do I run away? Or maybe I just graze? See, it's not a reflex. A decision has to be made. See, in my mind, I can see the decision-making process in my mind. I don't have any subconscious. You know, they talk about the Freudian subconscious. I can tell you, I can see all the junk. No, nasty little web pages. Oh, click them off. Nasty, nasty, nasty. I wish my spam filter worked a little bit better. And in questioning people, I found out that most people don't, you know, even see the rubbish. You know, I just click them off. I've got control of my mind, but I'm basically thinking with the visual thinking mind that's subconscious, I think, in most other people. I don't really have a subconscious. Let me tell you an interesting thing that happened when I avoided a car accident. I was driving down the freeway at 11 o'clock in the morning, nice sunny day, second day of hunting season, and an elk, the great big huge antlers, comes across the freeway. I was on the southbound. He comes across the northbound lane. I had maybe 3 seconds to react, and a picture came in my mind of a car rear-ending me. That would have been the consequence of braking really hard. Then another picture came in my mind of an elk on the windshield smashing through, and that would have happened if I swerved. And the third picture was an elk passing by in front of me. And now that I clicked on that choice, that was just slowing down, and the elk went by in front of the car, and I'm here today. But I saw that decision-making process. Now, how do I deal with really abstract things, abstract stuff? How do I visualize, you know, someone asked me, you know, something like justice? Well, I see the scales of justice. I see examples of different courtroom things. You know, I've read, you know, trial results of different things. Okay, what one was just, what one was not just. You know, it's by specific examples of just and unjust things. Now, this picture is my visual picture when I was a little child of the power and the glory in the Lord's Prayer. It's a rainbow with an electrical tower at the base of the rainbow for the power. See, the thing is, no picture, I don't think. That's just that simple. Now, this is very interesting research by Dr. Bruce Miller. He's here in California, and he looked at a type of Alzheimer's called frontal temporal lobe dementia. And in this type of Alzheimer's, the frontal cortex and the language parts of the brain are destroyed. And visual thinking, like this horse picture here, comes out of somebody with no previous interest in art. He found art and music talent would come out of these patients. And this would last for about 4 or 5 years, and then the Alzheimer's would destroy everything totally. And these references are in Animals in Translation. There's another one of these really beautiful pictures published in the journal Neurology. Now, people that are visual thinkers are often very good at hidden figure test. Okay, you see the hidden figure there? How many of you can see it inside the pink and orange figure there? Well, we're not doing too good today. Let me show you where it is. I hope this computer doesn't throw a fit for, see, it's right here. And if that was a snake, it would have bitten you by now. Now, you take the person with autism and you put them in the scanner. And they're good at doing this. Just the visual part of the brain is lit up. It's like a direct line into the visual part of the brain. The normal person's brain is a lot of other stuff lit up. So now I'm going to show you a more abstract way to use visual thinking. This is a visual symbol picture for the brain scan of the autistic person. I know this isn't a brain scan, but their brain scan is like a little cabin out in the wilderness, surrounded just by snow all around. A direct line, a little bright visual thing, and the other circuits, there's less, you know, interconnected circuits. The normal brain's like this lamp store. We got so many lamps here lit up that they may be interfering with the other visual parts of the brain. You know, this is an example of a more abstract type of visual thinking. And what's that all about? That's to remind me to talk about interconnectedness in the brain. You know, all the circuits that wire up the different brain sections. Because I have to have a picture as sort of a scaffold to think with. Otherwise, I just can't think. The thing is, when you hear a word, you see a word, you speak a word, or you just think about a word, different parts of the brain are turned on. And in the normal brain, they're wired up between all these different parts of the brain. But in the autistic brain, some of the work by Eric Horchain showed that these interconnections, there's less of them. And the one part of the brain that's normal is the visual cortex, the brain's hard drive in the back. That part seems to be more normal. Now, there's some people that have visual processing problems. One of the things that's a really big problem for people on the autism spectrum is sensory problems. We need to be doing research in sensory problems. And I talked to a whole bunch of people at the Mind Institute today about working on sensory problems. I do not have visual problems. But there's some people, when they look at something, visual images break up, like a mosaic. This picture's actually from Oliver Sacks' book, Migraine. And the images break up, and how can they see? People that have severe visual processing problems, I'll tell you right now, they are not going to be a photorealistic visual thinker because their visual system's goofed up and they can't get that information onto the hard drive. People that have this problem are often helped by things like the Erlen colored lenses, where they may have problems with fluorescent lights, with a rapid flickering that drives them crazy, and they may find a laptop screen a whole lot easier to use. When they go to read, the print may jiggle on the page. Now, this isn't everybody with autism. Well, the problem with autism is it's so variable. One person will have this problem, another person doesn't have it. I had problems with sound sensitivity. I can't stand scratchy claws. And they seem to be really cheapening up the genes because I'm having more and more time, more and more difficulty buying new jeans that don't itch. And I'm going to be really sad when I'm getting these old ragged ones where I go, well, I can't wear those. These are pretty good, but they itch more than some of my old jeans. I don't know where they're getting the cotton from these days, but it's just not the same. When I was a little kid and the school bell went off, it hurt my ears like a dentist drill. It was terrible. Now, how can you tell if a person's got a lot of sensory problems? Take them into Walmart. And if every time they go into Walmart, it's a giant big meltdown, big fit, they probably feel like they're inside the speaker at the rock and roll concert. And you can have people that are nonverbal that have this problem, and you can have a brilliant engineer that has this problem. And we need to be working on therapies for these sensory problems. They are some of the most debilitating things that can just make it impossible to tolerate a normal environment. I have, you go in, you test the auditory threshold. Everything's going to be normal, but that doesn't tell you anything about auditory detail. I do not hear hard consonant sounds clearly at all. People who remain nonverbal, it becomes even worse. These problems are inside the brain. I had a great speech teacher, and she enunciated and stretched out the hard consonants. I can't emphasize enough the importance of early intervention. Very young autistic kids. My mother hired a nanny, taught turn-taking, taught sharing, had to be taught these things. There were some expectations in the 50s for behavior, and we've got to differentiate between bad behavior, like throwing a little tantrum in church, for example, and things I couldn't do. I did have some problems with motor control in my hands. There's some kids we need to just allow two-finger typing on the computer because we want them to get literate. Manipulating a teacher, there needs to be consistent discipline between home and school. Because you better believe it, I tested the limits. I knew just which houses in the neighborhood I could do some really bad things, like melt chess pieces with a soldering iron. And I wouldn't have dared done that at home, and I wouldn't have dared do it over at the Woods house, because I would have been in a lot of trouble if I'd done that. Now, kids that are echolalic are often echolalic because they're not hearing that well. They're kind of repeating back. But be thankful if a kid is echolalic and he can sing a perfect commercial because the brain is programmed to talking. Now, this is some of Ami Klin's work where they put an electronic hat on a person, track the eyes. Now, in this paper, they pretty much make it all social. But look how slow the attention shifting is on the red line. That's the autistic line. The yellow person looks back and forth many, many times. Brains that have problems. And a lot of the things I'm telling you about sensory and I'm telling you about attention shifting, it applies to dyslexia, it applies to ADHD, and it applies to a whole lot of other learning things. Let's not get too hung up on all these labels. But the normal person can shift attention much, much, much more quickly. I process slowly. I need time. I have problems with long strings of verbal information. Give written instructions. If they can read, give them written instructions. It's going to be so much easier. Okay, another brain scan that got done on me is they had me in the scanner and they showed me all these weird old Pink Floyd videos, strange videos on learning how to fly airplanes, like flying over the Grand Canyon, pictures of buildings and all kinds of stuff, pictures of people. And I was trying to figure out where to get these crazy tapes from. They were obviously VHS, probably lots of copyright infringement. I was trying to figure out where they got them from. And so I tended to orient towards the pictures of objects because those gave me the most information as to where the heck the tape came from. The normal person tends to light up at the pictures of the people. I was trying to figure out where they got this goofy picture of a bridge from, and then I was seeing 1970s cars on it, and I go, well, where did they get this video from? But the thing is, we need to have people in this world interested in things. You like all your little cell phone toys? Well, they get made by people that have Asperger traits, that think these are just the coolest things. And I'm finding that there's 40, 50, 60-year-old Aspergers all over my industry, keeping meat plants running, working in electronics companies, doing computer work. Managed to keep those jobs because they were taught some social rules, like acting in the play. And that was pounded into them, you know, at a really young age. Scientists have learned a lot about the brain. Sensory problems are real. Let's get a lot more research done on that. You know, lower brain centers are immature. Circuits are abnormal between brain regions. The other thing is sensory problems are totally variable. One person will have a lot of visual problems. Another person will be hearing. A person either tends to be a visual, use the eyes the more, or use the ears more. I've seen people with dyslexia, and this is not true for all dyslexics, where they're auditory learners. They can remember everything they hear. That's not me, man. I gotta see stuff, or I don't remember it. I already discussed that the word-based tasks are processed in visual parts of the brain, and the frontal cortex just isn't used as much. You tend to use that hard drive more in the back. That's my website, grandin.com, and I certainly wanna thank everybody for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.